Well, hello. Eyes forward, yes. And thank you very much for coming along to this evening, where we're very delighted at the London Graduate School, University of Kingston, or Kingston University, even, to be hosting a talk with two very special visitors to the LGS, Alexander Galloway, a professor of media, culture and communication at New York University, and Dr. Ian James, reader in modern French literature and thought at the University of Cambridge. They, along with myself, have been working on the ideas, the strange ideas of François Laruelle, this philosopher stroke non-standard philosopher, take it as you will, working out of Paris for the last 30 or 40 years now, publishing a great deal of work that is now slowly coming into English translation, and a number of introductions, guides, commentaries are appearing. Ian James has a chapter on Laruelle in his excellent book, The New French Philosophy, and he's also working currently in the relationship between continental philosophy and naturalism, and given that in Laruelle there's this whole notion of a science of philosophy rather than a philosophy of science, it's well worth engaging with Laruelle's work there. Just last year, Alexander Galloway, who I'll introduce more formally in a moment, wrote Laruelle Against the Digital, using Laruelle's non-philosophy as a way to discuss ethics, aesthetics, all in the kind of the leitmotif of the analog versus the digital, which you might expand on here in a particular way. And my own book. Plug. They're all book plugs here. It's basically a book plug session. I nearly said something different there. It's very close. Book plug session. All thoughts are equal. Laruelle and Non-Human Philosophy. Out in Europe on the 1st of December. It's already out in America. And I'll talk a little bit about that. A use of non-standard philosophy to engaging with film studies, animal studies, and other areas. So, it's great to have you two here to discuss Laruelle's influence on your own work and ideas, but also in particular this idea of philosophy or non-standard philosophy as a usage of thought, a type of using of thought. Beyond mere application, perhaps, beyond, I would say, mere illustration, as in, here is an illustration from media studies or animal studies of what Laruelle thinks, but I don't obviously want to put words in your mouth, but perhaps also a way of implementing, of actually practicing non-standard thinking through these other domains, through these other fields. Difficult and challenging, though that may be, as a task, an objective maybe rather than always for any of us an outright achievement, and to get beyond the illustrative paradigm and into an actual usage of non-standard philosophy. Now, I'm just going to have what I'll do here, I'm not going to bang on for too long, just a wee spiel introducing Laruelle for anybody new to this person, just a couple of ideas from the background, and then what we're going to do is Alexander, 10-15 minutes, talk about your work and what you're getting out of this use. What do you do with non-philosophy? What do you do with non-philosophy? No rude replies from the accelerationists. And then Ian and myself, and then we're going to look at each other's work, a little bit of a discussion, and then open it up for a Q&A, which should take us to about 8 o'clock and so on. Okay, so François Laruelle was born 1937. Same year as Alain Badiou, his good friend in Paris, and he is professor emeritus at philosophy at the University of Nanterre, Paris, and is the inventor, and I use that term consciously, the inventor, this notion of invention is important to him, of something called most of the while non-philosophy, but more recently non-standard philosophy, in order to get away from connotations of this being an anti-philosophy or some sort of negation of philosophy. And he is indeed the author of, at this stage, 25 books counting. There's a new book that's appeared. There's basically almost a book every year, and the translations are trying to keep pace with this chap who, as he gets older, seems to get more productive. A new book on ecological thinking now, which is interesting, given that one of Laruelle's other American foremost commentators and translators is Anthony Paul Smith, who, in his text, A Stranger Thought, worked on a non-ecological, what he called non-standard ecological thinking through Laruelle, and Laruelle himself is now, in a sense, kind of responding to that commentary, which is interesting. But as I said, 25 books and counting, so there's a lot of material coming out of France, and it's a lot of it's being translated for various publishers like Polity and Bloomsbury and so on. Now, his project, as he sees it, is the attempt to envision philosophy as a material and to study it from a genuinely non-partisan point of view. Now, by that, as I read it, it is to understand the ideas of philosophy no longer as positions, intellectual positions, call it what you will, that are argued with, critiqued, or accepted, but rather raw material that is utilized. That's the notion of usage again. It is not a question anymore of how we should study philosophy philosophically from its own insight and from its own, if you like, set of criteria, however wide and disparate and contestable they may be, but rather of what, to use a quote, what should we make of philosophy itself? And to continue the quote, he also writes, there is a body of philosophy, a philosophical materiality, a conceptual and lived material, and one can treat philosophy as a part of physical nature. You treat philosophy as a part of physical nature. So, again, like that flip, and I said, it's not so much as with Ian's interest, it's not so much a philosophy of science, it's a science of philosophy. And if, in terms of materialism, this is not another philosophical materialism, it's not a philosophy of matter, but it's rather trying to think through the matter, the materiality of philosophy and of philosophical practice, whatever that might mean and wherever that might lead us. So in pursuing this task, he says, we must first avoid the circular method, as he puts it, of treating philosophy philosophically, and instead propose, quote, a means of causing thought to function otherwise than philosophically, unquote. This is neither to reject nor to surpass it in any recognizable philosophical terms. So he's not trying to outdo philosophy. He's not trying to be more clever than philosophy, more philosophical than the philosophers themselves, more Spinozist or a better Deleuzian or more consistent Deleuzian. He's taking all of the philosophies together en masse, so to speak, as a physical mass, equal then, but only by, in a sense, taking away their claims to somehow having epistemological or ontological privileged access to the real, let's say, but rather as all equally real. So this is neither to reject philosophy nor to surpass it, but such approach is only, quote, claims to succeed the faith and authority of philosophy, never to deny its reality, nor to refuse it at least a relative autonomy. It only negates, he says, that part of philosophy that can be negated, namely its, what he says, namely its sufficiency, which is another term for this notion of its self-ascribed authority, its privileged access to the real, understood in that way, philosophy understood in that way. So he wishes to utilize philosophy and will do so employing models from both the sciences, like biology and physics in his various texts, as well as the arts, such as photography and music. And this notion of expanding philosophy by thinking of it as a material practice, as a body, and and therefore equalizing the thinking of philosophy. It's no longer the prince of the sciences, it's no longer got privileged access. It is a type of thinking alongside other forms of thinking found in technology, found in media, found in my own interest in non-human life, in non-animal forms of what might be called thought, without wanting to try and be anthropomorphic even, but other forms of thinking that could be non-human philosophizing are thinkable, so to speak, or imaginable, or hypothetical in this non-standard approach, this what Laruelle also calls a democracy of thinking, but a non-representational democracy, I'm glad to say. So that's the background, and we're each of us going to talk about where to take that, and talking about maybe models, utilization, usage, and your own approaches. So let us begin with Alexander Galloway, as I said, is professor at New York University. He's also a writer and a computer programmer working on issues of philosophy, technology, and theories of mediation. I'm sure many of you here know of numerous works. He's the author of Protocol, How Control Exists After Decentralization, 2004, Gaming, Essays on Algorithmic Culture, and The Interface Effect, that was 2012. And his last book, as I mentioned, latest book at least, is on Laruelle, Against the Digital. So, after
you. Thank you. I was just thinking, as you were speaking, that maybe there's a sort of... so where did non-philosophy come from? And maybe the kind of a kind of weariness vis-a-vis a culture of one-upmanship in post-structuralism in particular, I think might have been, I know it just occurred to me now, but anyway, thank you both to Ian and John for being so gracious in having me here and taking part in this. What I'll do is I'll say something very quickly about the book, and then in the spirit of provocation, what are the uses of non-philosophy, I just want to propose a series of keywords or concepts that for me have been most, that have opened up or remain to be explored even. So what's going on in this book, Laruelle Against the Digital? I do have a rather idiosyncratic take on Laruelle. I set out not to offer some sort of critical annotation of his work or a synopsis or a straight kind of exegetical slant on his work. Instead, I wanted to simply collide the non-standard method with the concept of digitality. And I want to stress that it's the concept of digitality because the book doesn't really say anything about actually existing digital technologies like the web or networks or video games or computers or things that we can talk about, in other contexts. In its simplest sense, I define digitality, it's no mystery, latching onto the notion of discretization, making discrete. I define digitality as a process of distinction. So that to me is a way to create a connection with Laruelle's notion of the philosophical decision. Philosophy and digitality both require a fundamental act in which something is divided into two. Something is divided into two. So for example, metaphysics requires the notion of a division or a distinction between essences and instances, essences and manifestations. Or on a computer chip, data is modeled and processed by means of voltage differentials, right? On-off positions, true-false, 0-1. And that fundamental distinction, that fundamental action to me is important. Distinction, division, decision, discretization, and also maybe we could add a word like difference, which opens a whole can of worms, but I think that also needs to be on the table here. So the narrative conceit of the book is that we should turn our attention not so much to the proverbial zero and one of computer culture, but instead on one and two. What it means to move from one to two, and likewise what it means to move from two to one. And for me, digitality is the word that we give to the former, and the analog or analogicity is the word that we give to the latter. Okay, so what does this have to do with philosophy? Well, we know that thinking is digital. That, to me, is the easy part. Philosophical rationality has worked that way since Plato, and so it's no surprise that we see computers acting this way as well. And sometimes I get very frustrated with the so-called digital philosophers because that strikes me as just a kind of redundant terminology, right? There is no other philosophy than digital philosophy, a kind of philosophy that creates distinctions. So that's the easy part. For me, the hard part, and why I'm so, you know, kind of energized by Laruelle, is he lets us tackle what I see as a much greater challenge, which is to speculate about a way of thinking that is not digital. So in this sense, the book is nothing but a massive thought experiment. Is it possible to think non-digitally? If you've gotten very far into Laruelle, you know, in fact, that he rarely talks about the digital. There's one actual short piece on computation, and then you see references to it in other places. He does talk about actually existing science and technology that I think Ian will say more about, quantum mechanics in particular. Nevertheless, I see evidence of this logic of discretization on almost every page. So I think that through his sort of withdrawal from philosophy, I think that Laruelle is a profoundly non-digital thinker. And he might, in fact, be the only non-digital thinker we have. Okay, so very, very short, very, very short kind of introduction to what the book is about. Let me now just throw out, just also in the interest of eventually segueing into more of a conversation, let me throw out a series of keywords or concepts that for me have been the most evocative thus far in my exposure to this material. Okay, so the first term, keyword, is identity. What are the uses of identity in Laruelle? I'll say only this, which is he uses the concept and the term identity in a way that's almost diametrically opposed to the way in which that term has been used in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so of cultural studies and identity politics. In that discourse, identity is a way to think about difference. In Laruelle, identity is actually a way to think about, what can we call it? Sameness, real identity, right? Identity in the strict etymological sense of the word. Identity coming from the Latin term that means the very same. So you get in Laruelle all these outrageous things like tautologies, right? He has sort of rehabilitated the tautology as a intellectually valuable object. You might go so far as to say, in fact, that there is only one axiom in all of non-philosophy, and it's essentially A equals A. Right? And that's all you can say in non-philosophy, and it's the most brilliant, you know, profound thing you can say. Whereas for many other thinkers, the tautological identity equation is, I don't know, you know, maybe it's something that you talk about when you want to lay down some of the fundamental conditions of logic, but, you know, you move beyond it very quickly. So I've talked about this this use of identity, this use of tautology, maybe not without some hesitation, as a kind of autistic reason. So does Laruelle give us a new kind of autistic thought, autistic reason, based in identity? The second one is the concept of the generic. For me, the generic is the single most interesting and useful concept in all of Laruelle. We could talk about this more, but I see real close connections with the way in which Alain Badiou uses a kind of methodology of subtraction, right? I think that's connected. Are we perhaps in the middle of a renaissance in apophatic reason? That might be another way to think about the generic and how we get to the generic. What about inverting the principle of sufficient reason into something like a principle of insufficient reason? Can insufficiency and finitude act as, helper concepts that allow us to understand this idea of the generic? It's a complicated question. I think it's actually quite controversial, particularly given the way in which difference has played an important role in post-structuralism and a lot of other fields. So I would just, in passing, cite Katerina Kolesova's book on post-structuralist feminism and Laruelle, two things that you might not think would ever go together, but she makes them go together in this fantastic way. That might be one way to try to think beyond a philosophy of difference without losing the real political gains brought about by the intervention that was post-structuralism. Okay. The third concept is the idea of withdrawal. Withdrawal, again, not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, weighed down perhaps by a connection with actually existing political movements like Occupy. John, in his book, I think does an excellent job differentiating Laruelle's use of the notion of withdrawal from philosophical withdrawal, right? The idea that the philosopher is the one who takes a step back, right, in order to better gain perspective on the object that is being being contemplated. So can we have a notion of withdrawal that isn't closely bound to perspective, distance, and this notion of philosophical, the way in which withdrawal is used in philosophy, particularly in phenomenology, I guess, would be the best instance of that. Okay, well, let me just, I'll just mention maybe one last thing and then pass it off to Ian. Laruelle, there's some, it's this case with identity and the relationship to difference. Sometimes he forces you to contemplate terms and concepts that you thought you had forever gotten rid of, right? So something like determination, that derided and scorned concept, or even worse, destiny, fate, that constellation of terms, determination, destiny, and fate, have been brought back in a certain sense. So I'm happy because I can now come out as a vulgar determinist without any shame. So finally, and this certainly reflects my own bias, the last term I will use is the term theory. I wonder if Laruelle is in fact the greatest boon to critical theory since Louis Althusser. In other words, do we finally have a way to enact the edict given by Marx in the 11th thesis on Feuerbach that the best response to philosophy is to stop doing it? Can we finally disarm after so many centuries? Can we stand down? Can we demilitarize philosophy and transition into a theoretical undertaking? And here I'm hesitating because theory is actually not the word that Laruelle uses most frequently, but could we transition instead to what he calls a generic science. A generic science. So I'm kind of playing fast and loose a little bit and using theory and science more or less as synonyms. Okay, so that's just in the spirit of, you know, getting the conversation going and, you know, hopefully provoking you. Those are some of the concepts and areas that I find most interesting and that I hope to continue looking at in the future. So hopefully that will be a good segue to Ian, because I know that he wants to discuss this idea of science in Lauderwell.
Great.
Just quick introduction to equalize, I suppose. So Ian is at Cambridge, and his work is focused on 20th century and contemporary French philosophy. His latest research interests are in the contemporary turn, as I mentioned, within French philosophy towards science and technology. And he has previously authored books on Klausowski, The Persistence of the Name, 2009, The Fragmentary Demand, that was on Nancy, wasn't it? Yes. Paul Virilio, and the aforementioned New French Philosophy from 2012. Thanks.
Thank you, John, and thank you for the invitation to come and speak. It's great to be here. So as John mentioned, my current work on Lauderwell and what I'll be talking about today relates to a wider project which I hope to bring to fruition in a year or so, no time soon unfortunately, which is looking at the idea of post-continental naturalism in contemporary French thought. It's a term actually I think that I got from John's 2006 book on post-continental philosophy, An Outline. So this is within a wider context, but what I'm saying today I hope is quite focused. So one of the things we can do with non-philosophy or non-standard philosophy is rethink science. That is to say, we can rethink the meaning of the term science in its most general sense. At the same time, we can rethink the relation of philosophy to science, as it may be more traditionally understood, and in so doing, rethink also the epistemological status and operations of the natural sciences. It may seem initially very strange, however, that this non-philosophical, non-standard thinking, which affirms the real as unknowable and unrepresentable, can have anything sensible or reasonable to say about science. Science, after all, is most often understood in its realist aspiration as the collective endeavour to know reality as it is objectively and independently of human dispositions. Yet, as has been indicated, non-philosophy or non-standard philosophy, in fact, describes itself as a science or as science, and more specifically, as a science of philosophy. So how can we make sense of this strangeness? Well, much philosophy places both philosophy and science together in a relation of continuity or reciprocity. It was Bertrand Russell who argued in 1912 that, I quote, philosophical knowledge does not differ essentially from scientific knowledge. The results obtained from philosophy are not radically different from those obtained by science. In 20th century thought, this relation of continuity or reciprocity can be seen in different ways within strands of analytic philosophy, after Russell, within logical empiricism, and within philosophical naturalism of the kind associated with Quine. In such contexts, philosophy arguably takes authority from science through the use of specific techniques which can be aligned with the scientific method, or through an appeal to scientific knowledge as the ultimate arbiter and guide for philosophical knowledge. What philosophy takes from science, it then gives back in the laying of epistemological foundations, which would provide a universal ground for scientific activity as such, and for its ambition to achieve total and absolute knowledge of the real. By contrast, Lauderwell's thinking poses the heterogeneity and respective autonomy of both science and philosophy. Throughout Lauderwell's works, science is understood always, in one way or another, as a posture of immanence. And non-philosophy is aligned with science, or understood as science, precisely insofar as it shares this posture. So this means that science and non-philosophy are distinct from philosophy insofar as they present a non-thetic relation to the real, a relation which obeys a logic that is entirely different from the logic of representation known to or enacted by philosophy. So how is this posture of immanence to be understood? Firstly, we can say that for La Rochelle, science does not have or seek a philosophical foundation. It has no need of a philosophical foundation, he tells us, because it has a cause, an immanent cause, that of the real itself in its radical immanence. So the relation of science to the real is one of direct causation or determination, in the sense that it is not mediated by logic, by the universal concept of being, or any other mode of representation which would synthesize the real and represent it as such. As La Rochelle repeatedly tells us, science is determined in the last instance by the real as its cause, and this determination is one way or unilateral. The knowledge science gives does not itself in any way determine the real, but rather the order of the real unilaterally determines the order of knowledge. In contrast, philosophy is always trying to determine the real by representing it or conceptualizing it in and as the universality of being. What La Rochelle's thinking allows us to do here is to re-describe the sciences in the absence of philosophical and epistemological foundations, to describe them, if you like, non-epistemologically, so that the structure of scientific objectivity itself is derived solely from the posture of immanence and the logic of unilateral determination in the last instance by the real, and not by any specific distribution of the empirical or the transcendental within any one area of scientific inquiry. Now, one might object here that surely science uses concepts and representations all the time, in its theories, in its experimental hypotheses, and in the way in which it comes to configure both its objects of knowledge and the spatial and temporal frames within which those objects of knowledge are situated and known as such. And does not science talk of natural kinds, conceptual groupings that represent the objective structure or essences of the natural world? Does it not speak most preeminently of the laws of nature, regularities which represent the most general structure of the physical world or cosmos? Well, in fact, the non-philosophical and non-epistemological redescription of science and of scientific objectivity would allow scientific activity to be stripped of such preeminently philosophical and epistemological supports, such as the concepts of natural kinds and universal laws. It would also allow the representations, concepts, and experimental hypotheses of the sciences themselves to be understood non-philosophically as secondary in relation to the posture of immanence that is proper to science. To see how this may be so, and to highlight what non-philosophy does by way of a non-epistemological redescription of the sciences, La Rochelle's thinking can be compared to a number of positions within the philosophy of science itself. The essence of this redescription lies in the power of non-philosophical thinking to separate out, within scientific theory, thought, and practice, those elements which remain philosophical from those elements which are derived strictly from the posture of immanence. In their recent collaborative work, the Brazilian philosopher Roberto Mangabeira Unger and the American cosmologist Lee Smolin have offered a critique of dominant contemporary scientific theories, most notably Einsteinian relativity and quantum mechanics, a critique which argues that such theories have fused empirical and empirically verified insights with metaphysical prejudices. Much modern scientific theory, and particularly theories in theoretical physics and cosmology, have, Unger and Smolin argue, an empirical core, which is wrapped in rationalist metaphysical packaging inherited from the time of Newton. While the empirical core has been verified and has led to great success of these theories, The metaphysical packaging has ultimately proved to be limiting, in such a way that current science has locked itself into a series of impasses, impossibilities, and paradoxes. In particular, Unger and Smolin argue that the presupposition that science discovers timeless truths represented by timeless mathematical objects is a huge obstacle to the progress of knowledge and has led to sustained impasses in areas such as string theory or multiverse theory, which posit mathematical realities which can never be measured empirically. Smolin and Unger's solution to these impasses is to propose a temporal naturalism, which holds that the laws of physics develop in time and are not absolute. But most important from our Laroelian perspective is their demand that the rationalist, philosophical, and metaphysical prejudices of dominant scientific theories be identified as such, and that the marriage between the empirical, verifiable core of science and its metaphysical packaging or envelope be dissolved. The non-epistemological redescription of science would allow for just such a separation of empirical core and metaphysical envelope within scientific theory, allowing the core to be understood beyond its empirical determination as knowledge determined unilaterally by the order of the real, and the metaphysical envelope to be treated non-philosophically as materials or data, which would also be subjected to what Laroel would call a unilateralization in relation to the real. So what follows from Unger and Smolin's ambition to demetaphysicalize science is a view of scientific theory, practice, and collective endeavor which detaches them from any horizon of totality or of the absolute. As Unger puts it, there needs to be a clear recognition of, I quote, our groundlessness, our inability to grasp the ground of our being or existence. Without a grasp of ground, there is no grasp of totality. For Laruel, the scientific posture of immanence is one which is entirely distinct and separate from the eminently philosophical horizon of totality or of the absolute. So the separation of science from figures of unity and totality is in fact well established within the philosophy of science and is represented in the thought of the Stanford School, which includes eminent figures such as Nancy Cartwright, John Dupré, and Ian Hacking. In works such as Cartwright's The Dappled Universe and Dupré's The Disorder of Things, these philosophers present a scientific picture of the universe as ontologically plural. As empiricists and pragmatists, these philosophers, like Unger and Smolin, focus on the elements of science which are empirically successful in local experimental settings and seek to overturn the broader metaphysical assumptions of scientific theory, assumptions relating to the inherent orderliness and regularity of the cosmos, and the possibility of determining such orderliness through the discovery of independently existing and universal laws or natural kinds. It's in this context that the ultimate disunity of science is argued for as a corollary to the ontological plurality and disunity of the physical universe itself. Once again, what the non-epistemological and non-philosophical redescription of science would do in relation to such Stanford School accounts is to replace their underlying empiricism with the a priori of the real as one, such that the empirical or objective success of the sciences is derived from the logic of unilateral determination in the last instance. The arguments of thinkers such as Cartwright and Dupré relating to causality, reductionism, epistemic virtue, and to the social and cultural organization of the sciences and their methodologies would, according to a non-epistemological transformation, all be subsumed into the overarching and more general or generic logic of unilateral causation or determination by the real. The separation of science from overarching figures or horizons of totality or the absolute, and from any sense of an ontological foundation or ground, may seem to be an eminently desirable outcome for those of us who work within philosophical traditions that have devoted themselves to the critique, destruction, or deconstruction of metaphysics and of metaphysical foundations within philosophy. In relation to the natural sciences, it is perhaps a task that is long overdue, and continental anti-metaphysical thinking of the late 20th century may well prove to have been the avant-garde of such an endeavour. But to conclude, it must be asked what all this might mean for scientific theory and practice itself. Lee Smolin has argued that the separation of scientific practice from rationalist, philosophical, and metaphysical prejudice is a necessary precondition for current science to overcome its paradoxes and impasses. Whether scientists themselves can do things scientifically with a non-epistemologically redefined scientific practice would have to be a matter for them. But one might argue, though, that in fact, scientists are in a posture of immanence all the time, whether they recognize it as such, and that this is precisely, as Laruelle says, what defines science as such. It only suffices that we recognize this more explicitly for everything to change. So let's finally and briefly think about the recent debate within science between scientific realists and social constructivists, or scientific constructivists, and other debates within philosophy of science relating to conventionalism, instrumentalism, and realism. The late physicist and philosopher Bernard d'Espagnat, who died earlier this year, argued for an understanding of the real which is quite close to Laruelle's. His notion of the veiled real, in French, le réel voilé, was derived from an interpretation of the indeterminacies of quantum formalism. In a critique of mathematism which recalls that of Unger and Smolin, d'Espagnat held that quantum formalism never knows or seizes the fundamentals of the real as such, that the real always remains hidden, withdrawn from thought and knowledge. D'Espagnat also argued in favour of an enlarged causalité élargie. And this is a causality that would operate not between phenomena, but exclusively from the real, upon or to phenomena, thus explaining the effectivity of quantum measurements, but also their incompleteness. This really very strongly recalls Laruelle's unilateral causality and determination in the last instance by a real that is itself unknowable and unrepresentable. In the light of d'Espagnat's veiled real and Laruelle's non-epistemological vision of the real as indivisible and inaccessible to thought, the debates between scientific realism and constructivism, conventionalism and instrumentalism fall away. Or more properly, all these positions are equalized in relation to the real. For whether one adopts a scientific realist posture or a constructivist, conventionalist or instrumentalist posture in relation to the results of scientific experiment, in the light of Laruellian non-epistemology, everything from the objectivist realist configurations of experimental practice to the social and cultural determinations that inform such practice, to the mathematical and conceptual conventions which underpin such practice, everything and anything we can specify in relation to the activity of science is subordinate to or secondary in relation to the logic of unilateral determination in the last instance by the real. There may be worldly and specifiable determinations, theoretical, practical and experimental, cultural and social, but these would be determinations in the first, second, third, or nth instance, always themselves ultimately determined in the last instance by the real. So Laruellian non-philosophy and non-epistemology would allow for a grand clearing of the way with regard to the different epistemic positions within philosophy of science. And it would enact a separation of science itself from its metaphysical prejudices, its obsession with figures of the absolute and of totality. If there is one thing we know, it is that the scientific theories of today will certainly be superseded by the theories of tomorrow, that scientific knowledge, for all its objectivity, is always provisional and incomplete. Laruellian non-epistemology allows science to adjust its horizons to a certain modesty that comes with the suspension of philosophical horizons and the operation of the philosophical decision within science. But it also allows science to continue and develop, its real knowledge of the real being guaranteed by the unilateral determination of the real itself.
Well, a round of applause for both Alex and Ian there. Right, hello. John O'Melica here. I'm Professor of Film and some philosophy at Kingston. I won't talk for long, and actually I'm probably going to abuse my position by forwarding my remarks by bouncing a few ideas, well, without giving you a chance to respond, but afterwards perhaps. I was taken by Alex's formulation of this notion that with Laruelle you are able to come out of the closet in different guises, as a determinist, I believe in determination.
A vulgar determinist.
Vulgar, with the determinist with the everyday, with the ordinary man, I suppose, person. I think it's interesting in as much as, obviously, we're in the neighborhood of philosophies, theories, dubbed the New Realism, the New Realists, New Materialism, Continental Naturalism of a sort. But what I think is interesting is that Laruelle's take on that, whereas, again, without wanting to distort others' positions, there is a way in which you can think of some of these other philosophies he is connected with as a kind of taking of a certain science, take neurology, for instance, neuroscience, and giving it an interesting, if you like, continental spin. Mm. So you can talk about the plasticity of the neuron. Or if you go into mathematics, you can look at the paradoxes of the theory that disrupt and create eventual thinking. Mm. So you're taking the authority of a science, but giving a certain continental difference, multiplicity, in order to make it, this is a concept we can do work with. It's not that science equals, and its concepts equals fascism. There is the kind of open pluralist science we can use if we take certain ideas and spin them all away. But I still think there is, nonetheless, the authority of the science still at play in these new implementations in the new realists. And maybe people in the audience will beg to differ and say, no, I'm being unfair there. Mm. Whereas with Laruelle, I think, and we can talk about this afterwards, are there hints in Laruelle's latest work when he talks about the quantum and quantum mechanics? Is he giving that science a particular authority now over thinking as a model? As opposed to the other models he has used for thought from biology or photography and so on. Is this now the paradigm? I'm not sure. But what's interesting is that I think if Laruelle was to formulate what it is to be an avowed vulgar determinist, what he would say is he believes in determination without determinism. He'd always have that kind of without structure. I talk about him as a behavioral thinker without behaviorism. Mm. Because once you have the without is in order to withdraw, if you like, from that philosophical position which commandeers and exhausts and gives a certain privileged view of this is what behavior is, this is what determination is. Whereas the notion of determination in the last instance, or by the real, leaves it open and indefinite. So you can be a determinist without determinism, if you like, that kind of thing. And I think that notion of without is his version of subtraction. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think that we can talk a bit about the generic generated by subtraction versus generic generated by this withoutness. But I'm just going to talk about very quickly is I think it's also connected to, and this I hope follows from Ian's talk, to fiction and the role of fiction. Another name for non-standard philosophy is philo-fiction, hyphenated, philo-fiction. And this is a very important area of Laruelle's thinking and what he is doing. And in a way, in my own recent text on Laruelle, what I do is I multiply a certain number of models. I think to myself, well, okay, how am I going to think through Laruelle without any particular authority? In other words, I'm not trying to teach Laruelle, this is the way you understand Laruelle through this image or this model, but using his own practice, if you like, the way he does or uses philosophy, I multiplied the models. He talks about the possibility of what he calls a modelist explosion when doing non-philosophy. You can model and model and model, and they are all equal. They are all equally philo-fictions. But so I'll have to say something about what he means by fiction there as compared to maybe other philosophers, Deleuze, let's say, on science fiction, or even or Derrida. But I think that's interesting, that notion of multiple models, no one of which is privileged, in order to give them a certain equal standing, so to speak. Okay, now on a little kind of advert for this on Twitter and Facebook and social media, I used a quote that I'd like to repeat here concerning this notion of usage and practice and non-philosophy. It comes from his latest text, one of his later translations, Struggle in Utopia. And the quote is this: "A great misunderstanding, in fact, threatens non-philosophy, that of its spontaneous definition," he doesn't like definitions, "as a theory or even as a practice," against everything I've just been saying. "It is neither one nor the other, of course, neither practical theory nor theoretical practice, or of," and he has scare quotes, "theory, but a future thought, or in the last instance, determining a subject for the non-relation of theory and practice." For the non-relation of theory and practice. Now, non-relation here, again, whenever you see non-hyphen in Laravel's writing, you should put in a word standard there, I think. Non-standard. It's not the negation. He's not that type of a thinker. So it's a non-standard relation. But, of course, what does that mean? It could just be a hostage to fortune. Now, the important thing, therefore, about fiction for Laravel, as he says, is that it should not be thought of in his work as a form of non-being. And this is indeed clear when he talks about science and fiction. The relations, on the other hand, between philosophy and science in French thought, more generally, have always been multivarious. One tendency, and this is already a rather potted history, has been to mix scientific evidence with certain philosophical truths in the tradition running from at least Bergson through to Alain Badiou, and also having Merleau-Ponty and Lacan in its number. Another tendency belongs to the philosophy of science, or French epistemology, Cavalier, Conguillaume, Bachelard, Foucault, and so on, being less interested in using evidence for other philosophical ends than it is in the evaluation of evidence in general, epistemology. A third group, let's say, see philosophy and science linked through literature and fiction. And in fact, Gilles Deleuze wrote explicitly on the need to see philosophy itself as a species of science fiction. In his Nietzsche and Philosophy, he wrote of how, quote, "Nietzsche had his own conception of physics, but no ambition as a physicist. He granted himself the poetic and philosophical right to dream of machines that perhaps one day science will realize by its own means." That's interesting to think of. So that one day science will realize by its own means. And I'm thinking that as an echo perhaps of Laravel talking about a future thought or in the last instance. Now the same thing that Deleuze says of Nietzsche could be said of Deleuze himself, as perhaps philosophy's preeminent science fiction writer on rhizomes, desiring machines, and time images. Jacques Derrida, on the other hand, moving in a somewhat different direction, saw philosophy, arguably, let's say in his early middle work, as a species of fiction within literature. Whereas, most famously, Alfred Jarret, in another fashion, characterized his pataphysics as a science of, quote, imaginary solutions, unquote, employing all the playfulness of a literary and theatrical avant-garde. Now, Laravel, I believe, could be seen as a figure uniting both of these literary, more literary positions, the one who was operating within a broader paradigm still, using the notion of philo-fiction as the overarching category for an equalizing approach to science, philosophy, art, and indeed every discourse. And that's a rather large claim, every discourse, but I think it's, you know, possible to point it out. Naturally, The fiction here is not opposed to the real, for it is itself coming from the real in the last instance, and so functions according to a non-classical concept of real identity, not logical identity, as Alex was saying. Here's a nice quote, then, from Laruelle on this. Except the completion of fiction's derealization, radicalize the historical but fruitless attempts to retract every claim to reality or co-production of reality from it. This obviously requires non-classical means. The real no longer is the auto-position of an identity, which are not deconstructive. The real can no longer be the other, first and foremost. What Laruelle uses this term, not translated from the French, the fictional, with an E. The fictional is therefore this ultimate essence of all fiction or its phenomenal given. It is what makes fiction real, i.e. accessible to every man before its very usage under the technical conditions of literature or art or philosophy. So this is a notion of the, what he calls otherwise, philofiction or fictional, that comes before usages or conditions in literature, art, or philosophy. Now, by dissociating fiction from any claim to approximate reality, then, naturalism, verisimilitude, neorealism, and so on, its own radical real can emerge. Here's another quote. It seems that, rather than a total thought which would again claim to synthesize every experience or simply to make them intercede diagonally, non-philosophy is situated at the one point of reality capable of joining without decision or contradiction the effects of philo-fiction, poetry fiction, religion fiction, science fiction, etc., on condition of understanding that these fictional aspects, far from simply extending philosophy, poetry, etc., in imaginary forms, are instead the image of themselves that the wholly other which non-philosophy is gives upon the mirror of philosophy, of poetry, and so on, unquote. So in this notion, non-philosophy frees philosophy, Laruelle says, quote, as a fiction, which no longer has anything but one last link with philosophical sufficiency, unquote, or authority. It delivers it from the, quote, substantial or humanist burdens of the real, that is, from the demand to approximate the real, verisimilitude, and so on, unquote. Whereas the parceling out of possible and the impossible as psychological, epistemological, physical, metaphysical, or logical phenomena is itself a philosophical enterprise, philofiction would be, as he puts it, quote, invention by fiction and rigor of philosophical possibles, unquote. It is a, to quote again, generic mise en fiction of epistemology and its universals, or what Anne-Françoise Schmidt names a mise en hypothèse. It is the mise en, the setting, vector, as he also puts it, performance or use, that invents a usage of philosophy qua fiction, as he puts it. Philo-fiction, or pure invention, has the rigor or consistency of fiction, therefore, much like Alain Badiou follows the rigor of mathematical conventions, but, I would say, without saturing it to the authority of mathematical science, as Badiou arguably does. As a philosophy non-standard, one of Laruelle's later books puts it, a scientific philo-fiction involves a statistical production of quantum and probabilistic fictions, unquote. Now, the very usage there of quantum maybe is a hostage to fortune, so it might be worth interrogating his use there. So two things, two truths even, or many of them, many models, may be quantum superposed, but on the basis of the real rather than, let's say, philosophical dialectics. And this superposition, this coincidence even, has a fictional rigor to it, that is, an invented rigor, the rigor of invention, not convention, akin to the science of the quantum, where life and death can coexist, as with the unfortunate Schrodinger's cat. Performative invention then can move through contradictions, impasses or aporia of sufficient reason, when it enacts new kinds of thought, of logic, of identity, of determination, and so on and so on. All of those standard philosophical terms can be reinvented. So, to sum up then, Fundamentally, for Laruelle, philosophy has never been able to think through the fictionality of fiction, other than as variants of, as he puts it, least being, or limitrophy of the real, or, quote again, nothingness that echoes superposed real reference as well as its contraries, science, truth, being, perception, etc. Kant and Fichte, for example, founded it on imagination. Nietzsche saw it as a willed entity. In sum, then, the history of, quote, fiction's philosophical ambition is without appeal. It is a failure. Not only has fiction ultimately found philosophy opposing it once again to the instance of the real and limiting it in its will to power, but it has also not been able to acquire a concept, a reality, and an autonomous dignity at last. It remains too close to the artifact. However, the reasons for this failure are clear. Fiction has always been thought in philosophy's framework and has combined with the history and crossroads of philosophy. Philosophy tolerates fiction on condition of announcing itself to it and deciding on its essence. Thus, what is being investigated here is not a particular philosophical position of fiction in relation to the real, but philosophy's legislation or right over it. So for Laruelle, then, fiction can no longer be thought of as a mode of non-being, of the false, but rather seen, as you would say, in one, or according to the real. There is no distance from the real that would allow fiction, let's say, to miss its target or only approximate a target. It is its own target, its own real, qua fiction or usage. Okay, so I'll stop there and have a little gap. And, oh, yeah, thank you very much. We'll edit out that somewhat charitable beginning to the clap. We can put in some extra crowd noise. So, anyway, I would like to begin then, if you don't mind, we'll just start off and then we'll just go around the houses. And let me start with Ian then, and science. There is, as you know, and as some here will know, many here will know, different iterations of this non-philosophy, non-standard philosophy, from one through to, we're currently on, model five. And in model three, my personal favorite, there is this absolute equality, it seems to me, that is professed and practiced between all forms of thought, scientific in that sense of the natural sciences or even life sciences, as well as art and technology and ethics. He has a kind of strange kind of use of the word ethics there, alongside models of thought from philosophy. So they're all being equalized. When we get to this notion of the quantum and later thinking, he seems to be almost as an echo of Badiou. Badiou, who says that philosophy should not be sutured to art or to science, etc., etc. When philosophy gets sutured to one of its conditions, like science, you end up with a kind of analytic philosophy of science, and it isn't proper thinking, and so on and so forth. And then he says, and the model for thinking about all of this that I'm going to use throughout, because it's the model of ontology, is from set theory mathematics. Where does it get its privilege, and so on and so forth. You kind of, Laruelle seems to have that same, despite his own issues with Badiou, Laruelle seems to have that same move. Mm-hmm. It seems a quantum somehow captures the essence of, one, all the sciences, and two, of what he is doing with in his non-philosophical practice. Mm-hmm. So, if you can both come in on this, yeah. Is something more, I'm kind of, you know, of a view that something more must be going on, but what is it, would you say?
I just wanted to pile another thing on your, on your shoulders here, which is a specifically mathematical discipline, which is algebra, right? So algebra is something that is privileged as well in Laruelle, and I don't know if you have thoughts about that, too. Mm.
Wonderful. Yeah, so, I mean, I get the sense that in some of the early work, in books like En Tant Qu'un, despite there being a clear logic of equalization at work that you say, and that's undisputable, he does seem, in that earlier period, to still want to give some privilege to science. Science as theory, science as science of philosophy. He says at one point in that book that, you know, there's more thought in Riemann and Einstein and Bohr than there is in anything like Hegel and Heidegger and stuff like that. So, you know, at moments he does seem to give way some kind of privileging of science, because it's the scientific posture. Mm. Although it necessarily emerges from that posture of immanence that I talked about, that all things have to be equal in relation to the real, because the axiom of one says that they are. So in many ways, I think in the later period, that privilege, despite the dominance of the quantum model, that relative privileging of science, I think, disappears. That might seem counterintuitive, given the amount of usage that the language of the quantum undergoes in the late period. But in one of his recent works, I think from 2008, which is not translated into English, Introduction aux sciences génériques, which those of us who read in French will know, he very much talks about his latest period foregrounding experimentalism and foregrounding any one act of thought or any one book as creating what he calls an enceinte expérimentale, which is slightly difficult for me to translate off the cuff, but it's kind of drawing a kind of an experimental circle or region, drawing a line within which non-philosophy will occur as an experiment in thought. And I think it's in that context that we need to understand the use of quantum, the language, the conceptuality of quantum formalism. He does what he does elsewhere in his work. He extracts something from a particular area and treats it as materials. So, you know, he reminds us that the language of quantum mechanics isn't really meant to be taken as it would be if you were a scientist doing quantum mechanics. It's extracted as materials and related back to the its generic condition of being. And so it does take on a privileged status, but purely within that kind of experimental performative context. And that's how I would view that, because I can see, you know, there is a sense that maybe he's giving it some kind of, you know, ontological privilege as the best language to talk about the imminent real or the generic. And maybe that's a hard accusation to get away from, but the only way to negotiate it, I think, would be to underline the experimental character of his extraction of the language of quantum mechanics. It works for him because quantum mechanics always talks in terms of operators and states, and never in terms of things or realities. Mm. So if he wants to try and get a kind of a mode of thinking, to perform thinking as a kind of a wave function or a collision of materials, it kind of figuratively works for him, but in a purely experimental creative fashion, which means that in recent works such as Christo Fiction, he can take the language, the conceptual language of quantum mechanics, and collide it with the language of Christic theology. So you get this kind of extraordinary splicing of theological and quantum mechanical language in order to talk about some messianic imminent experience, you know. So I think it seems to me to be a very sharp question which he needs to answer, and that's as best that I can answer it, really. Because in that late period, I think the motif of philo-fiction, as you've, you know, described so well, is one of the dominant motifs, and quantum mechanics is just another part of philo-fiction, along with everything else. Which, if you relate that back to my paper, poses the question of, you know, what then becomes the specificity of the hard sciences that I was talking about? What would they make? Or, you know, Alphonse Schmidt, who is a philosopher of science who you cited, who works very closely with Lowellian thought, you know, as someone who herself works with practicing sciences, what she would do with this kind of radical equalization of philo-fiction in the later period. And I think the thing that I always bear in mind is that for Lowell, all the regional sciences, all the regional disciplines, all the things that John was talking about, you know, film, art, all these things, they are equalized in relation to the real only, to the generic real. They maintain their worldly specificities and their heterogeneities and their specifics in relation to the world, in relation to what they're doing in the world. So generic science, as he calls it in his late period, equalizes everything according to the motif of Philo Fiction in the way you described, in relation to the immanent real, whilst maintaining their specific worldly heterogeneities. Mm. So science can carry on, do what it does, and simply be re-described, as I said it, in terms of the earlier language of the posture of immanence or the later language of generic science. But it carries on almost untouched. Mm. It's just us, from the perspective of Lauella, re-describing it.
Yeah. So would it be fair to say then that for him, quantum theory is not so much a privileged language, but a, I don't know, just a kind of convenient vocabulary that happens
fiction.
To...
It's a Philo Fiction, exactly the sense that, that John
I think it's interesting John as described. Much as some people have been frustrated with Laruelle only having a rather suggestive use of quantum mechanics or even algebra. Compared to, let's say, a Karen Barad, who might go deeper into quantum mechanics, and you certainly could compare it with Badiou, his use of set theory and category theory is nowhere near that. He is not, in any way, it's not simply some humility and just keeping his you know, autodidactic scholarship off the page. I think it is a suggestive use in the kind of positive sense of that, without wanting to hammer home the authority of the quantum mechanics. And it's interesting, in his most, what you might call his scientistic phase in Non-Philosophy 2, I think Antoine Cuin is from that period. Even there he says, interestingly, that it is not about, you know, it used to be that philosophy was the princess of the sciences, the queen of the sciences, and everything else was regional knowledge. Mm-hmm. So the regions of science and all the rest, and you've got your Cartesian tree imagery and all the rest of it, philosophy at the center. It's not that now we have, in a kind of this science of philosophy, science at the center and philosophy at the image. Rather, science is the thinking that has no center. It is the decentering thinking. Mm-hmm. Per se, and it is, and then alongside this notion of the hypothetical, putting into hypothesis the experimental method, I think there he is looking at the sciences, want to call it generically, or certainly a certain kind of tendency, universal tendency in the sciences that he wants for philosophy, that allows for the experimental method to get rid of this notion of sufficient authority, etc., etc. And perhaps he finds in quantum mechanics one particular science where the method seems to match the findings and the results because of the notion of probability and so on and so forth,
sure,
and entanglement that
sure
lead to a kind of pluralism.
And so the motifs of superposition that he gets from quantum science, superposition allows scientists to describe an instance where states coexist, they're superposed on one on the other, and that gives him an ideal image for what he might elsewhere refer to as, I know, the duality, the unilateral relation of duality. It's a similar logic, and I think algebra performs the same function. To go back to your question, what he's most interested in algebra is the quality of idempotency.
Yeah.
Idempotency. 1 + 1 = 1, and so it's precisely something that, just as, you know, superposition in quantum mechanics and formalism allows a figure for what he's trying to think formally, so does idempotency within algebra. It precisely allows for a non-logical, non-dialectical, non-mediated relation of identity or sameness of the real as one. So in a sense, that comes back to that he is kind of privileging it because because it does allow, it comes closer to his formalism.
Mm. Well, again, you might say he's a type of experiment. In any one time, there's a kind of, I think, an experiment with the thought. And in this thought, I will privilege this kind of vocabulary.
Exactly.
But, you know, given everything I've done before, don't think that I am now, you know, saying quantum mechanics captures the real or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I think there is, And I use in one of the chapters, another model for looking at them is from performance art, not just performativity or speech act theory and things like that, but something more broadly. There is in his behavior, his acts of philosophy,
right,
a kind of performance going on. That's another way of looking at experiment, but this time from an artistic background rather than...
And it's decisive. Quantum formalism is just the language he's using now to perform non-philosophy.
Right.
And it will change, and film... just as good.
I think it is possible now, as Alex was saying, you can come out of the closet now. If you wanted to write that book or that paper about time and metaphysics and something, a mind-body problem, something about free will and determinism and the brain, yeah, you can write it now and talk about, you know, neurons and synapses and what makes it and so on and so forth, and not be derided as pre-critical or haven't you read your Derrida that was deconstructed long ago and so on, but at the same time not as a kind of naive realist. You're in a sense you're
great.
Experimenting with models of thought and you can collide your neuroscience with, and you know, take anything you want from art, you know, take some photography or what have you, and take something from theology and talk about particles of Christ and bring those that language together to produce not a new theology to sell to people with a, you know, and so on, from some sort of Church of I Hate You kind of thing, but rather to experiment with thinking in its rather wilder assemblages, let's say, to go all Deleuzian finally. But sorry,
you're using a lot of Deleuzian vocabulary.
I know. Yeah, coming out of the closet here, it's Bergson, really. It's just the original Deleuze, as we all know, of course. Did you want
I mean, that's a legitimate question. I think, even in a kind of friendly challenge, I wonder if the later... it's almost like the later Deleuze kind of becomes a little bit more Deleuzian, and I can't help through, particularly the idea of superposition, I just can't help but think about the virtual.
So the later Laruelle becomes more Deleuzian?
Yeah,
So what's the way of thinking that other version of the statement? I think this is a passing phase. It's not my favorite one, actually, to be all honest about it. I think there is a kind of performance and experiment, and it's interesting, these languages being collided together and so on. And the notion of collision versus an assemblage, an abstract machine, and so on and so on. Yeah, that does lead, that kind of, obviously, it does lead to a kind of naturalism and philosophical vocabulary that you get in Deleuze, especially Deleuze and Guattari,
yeah,
working together. Mm-hmm. And Guattari being the slightly wilder thinker of the two, and then famously, you know, Deleuze takes his kind of combinations and hammers them and smooths them out and makes them into a consistent plane of immanence and all that. I think there is something there, but I still like to think of it alongside, you know, his more recently... early writings, but nonetheless recently translated writings on photography,
yeah,
in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And he's kind of upgraded them or updated them with a kind of quantum spin, with the photo fiction sequel. But the original concept of non-photography, I think, is very interesting. You might say it comes from a kind of more phenomenological background to his writing, which is there. It's obviously there from Michel Henry and so on and so forth. He's got this kind of, he's got a bunch of influences on his background. Marx as well as Deleuze and Derrida. There's lots of things going into his work. And that, I think, even though that is perhaps anachronistic, I put them, I kind of, leaving aside temporality, I kind of flatten all the timeline and put them all along as viable models. Not that the latest model is the best model, it's just the current model, according to time.
And that follows from the whole axiomatics of the one. Yeah, it's as if he's been doing the same thing in different ways, and they all go horizontally. And you know, I think your intuition at the beginning of what you said about some of these contemporary philosophies engaging with science do so in a way that still kind of preserves a certain authority, a certain epistemological authority of science. I think that's true of someone like Malabou and Stiegler when they refer to neuroscience. It's as if, exactly as you say, they're going to do nice, funky, continental things with it, but they do it, import its authority as science. And I just don't think Lauwel does that. You know, his thinking in the way that I was trying to approach it really has its own authority in relation to immanence, an imminent experience, a posture of immanence. He believed that's something that science shares, natural science shares, but he's not trying to catch any authority from the sciences, which is precisely why his thinking can go back to them and re-describe them in total non-epistemological sense. And that's almost unique, I think, actually, in contemporary thought.
Can I ask Alex to say a little bit more about the non-digital and the analogical, in your approach to Lauwel, in as much as you make this equation, stroke analogy, of digitality and decision as a kind of distinction, creation of discreteness, and even perhaps difference, as I think you put it. Now, there is the way in which Lauwel goes through his kind of where he is vis-a-vis the history of philosophy. It's kind of like there is, on the one hand, the Greek metaphysics of identity, which ultimately leads to a kind of Aristotelian logic as well, with the logical identity of A equals A and that kind of thing. The metaphysics of identity then that has its other, in every sense, in Jewish philosophy of otherness and difference, which he sees running through every philosophy of difference, be it Judaic per se or Jewish persons, figures or not, so that would include Deleuze. But then there's another notion of identity, and you contrasted that with the last 20 years of identitarian thinking. But I was wondering about how his notion, as you would see it, of real identity, which isn't an identity of difference, but an identity of the one, or the equal, let's say, but that's just me, don't worry about it. Just the one, right? That identity of the one, how does that map onto, or have its analog in analogy or the analogical, without you kind of, the word you gave away was sameness, which is a difficult word. You don't want to say homogeneity and where that's going and that kind of thing. So how might this pan out in a way that doesn't want us to go screaming back to the digital or even a non-standard digital? At least that's got difference on its side and identity of difference rather than this identity, this real identity, yes, but what else is it? When you map it onto the analog, what does that mean?
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of, I think, for me, what was fun about trying to collide these two discourses or sets of questions together. And, you know, we've been using this term collider, and Lauwel is using this in a very literal sense, referring to, like, you know, super colliders that are colliding subatomic particles against each other. So the short answer is, I think that we shouldn't say that in withdrawing from digital thinking or digital philosophy, therefore Lauwel should be understood as a thinker of the analog, right? I think both digitality and analogicity are modes of representation. They just happen to differ on the logic of representation. And so to the extent that non-philosophy does not participate in the representational logic, then non-philosophy would be alongside of both analogicity and digitality. Although, I do think analogicity is a kind of nice garden path that you can be led down in here if you want to, think immanence, right? So analogicity as the suspension of distinction. So why would we want to do that instead of digitality? Well, I just think that the division from one to two that's the division that has always been privileged in philosophy, right? You try to think essence vis-a-vis its many worldly manifestations, right? God the Father, God the Son. So going from one to two, for me, I think is a much more dominant way of thinking. Why not try to, shift and look at this move from two to one? You mentioned real identity, and I think we should underscore that this isn't a normative or kind of moral tone that we want to strike here. And by real, Laruelle would qualify that and maybe say something like radical identity or identity understood in its most radical sense, which we must qualify perhaps. Radical for Laruelle doesn't necessarily mean kind of militant or political radical. It means, the way I would gloss the term is the thing that is most fully determined. So if you have radical identity, that would be identity to the extent that it has been most fully determined, right? So I don't know if that is an adequate response, but
I think it's fascinating in terms of, because you were mentioning Deleuze, the ghost of Deleuze is everywhere. Because I was thinking of Masumi, the kind of the superiority of the analog, and then I was thinking about Deleuze and Guattari and their magic formula of monism equals pluralism, as perhaps And you could think of other holistic thinkers, Whitehead, perhaps Bergson, and so on, and turn back to Laruelle and say maybe you protest too much by saying that all other philosophers are about thinking about duality and division. There are others, and what about Deleuze and Guattari? Monism equals pluralism.
Yeah.
Is there still something in their formulation of that magic formula of their practice of philosophy, do you think, from Laruelle's point of view, that still doesn't get the analog?
I think Laruelle is very close to Deleuze, and he will sometimes fess up to that. And Deleuze is, however, he's a kind of brother in imminence, I think is maybe one phrase at one point. But he's almost so close that he has to be violently rejected, right? So someone like Michel Henry is close and intimate, and he will allow some kind of, he will admit that there is a affiliation there. Deleuze is close, but he has to be rejected because he didn't go far enough. And I'm reminded in what you're saying of the way in which Deleuze deals with equivocity and then in favor of univocity, right? So Deleuze wants to reject this kind of Aristotelian legacy of the equivocity of being, right, in favor of univocity. And I think Laruelle does something very similar. It's just in his own estimation, Deleuze just didn't have the guts to follow it all the way to the end. He couldn't think it's a funny immanence phrase. As identity. He could only think immanence as difference.
And I think something about in following something to the end, that's often this notion of consistency, of consistent practice of what you are saying, saying what you do and doing what you say as it keeps on saying. And that sense of consistency, and that's another way of reading radicality. Yeah. Radicality meaning in oneself, doing it consistently on the roots of oneself, in the radical roots of oneself, in one's practice all the time, rather than falling back into a certain kind of philosophical position, which is suddenly practicing an authority rather than practicing a non-authority over these things.
And I do think, I wasn't kidding earlier in suggesting that, there is a single axiom in all of non-philosophy. And part of this kind of outrageous proposal that we get from Laruelle is, what would it mean to only have one axiom? Not 10 commandments, not the Bill of Rights, not, there is no list, there's no roster, there's a single intervention.